From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Andrew Lawler says if you look at modern industrial chickens, the hybrid breed that feeds most of the world today, birds Lawler describes as teeming, clucking, metabolizing, and defecating hordes, it's hard to remember these are the same creatures worshipped throughout the ancient world as symbols of fertility or for their ability to fight. But forget about the chickens in factory farms for a moment. Think about the ones in your neighbor's backyard or your backyard. That's what we're talking about today, the joys and challenges of urban chickens. We'll talk about the surprisingly rich history of these birds, but we're hoping to hear from you today, those of you who keep chickens. Why? What do you get out of the experience? Aside from the eggs, of course. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about chickens. Part of what we're interested in is how this trend of urban chickens caught on and how it works to raise chickens, what the experience is like, what you get out of it. So we're hoping to hear from you a little later in the program. Those of you with little flocks in the backyard, what are you getting out of the experience? Is this a practical thing, something you're doing for the eggs or maybe the meat? And how do you describe your relationship with the birds? Do you see them as pets? What are they like, your chickens? And what is it like to keep them in the city? What do the neighbors think, for example? You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. You can send us an email as well. You can also join us on Facebook or on Twitter. We're going to begin today, though, with a natural history of the chicken, where the birds came from and how we've changed them over the years. Joining us on the program is Andrew Lawler, who is a freelance journalist who's written articles about the natural history of chickens. He's a contributing writer for Science Magazine. His writing has appeared in the Smithsonian Magazine, as well as National Geographic, Discover, others. Joining us today from the studios of member station WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina. And Andrew Lawler, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess we should begin by saying that that when you started writing about the history of the chicken, you didn't really have all that much interest in the bird, and you didn't really know that much about chickens when you started.
No, in fact, I was a little reluctant to take it on. The editor of Smithsonian suggested it to me after I had pitched a perfectly fine story about Bronze Age sailors moving from India to the Arabian Peninsula at around 3000 BC. It was an exciting story. They'd found some archaeological evidence of Indians in Arabia at that early date, really the first vital sea trade that took place on the globe, the first globalization. So I had pitched that story, and the editors were somewhat interested, but they told me to go back and get a little more information. Well, what did these people bring? And I said, well, they brought all kinds of things. They brought lapis lazuli from Afghanistan, bringing it to ancient Mesopotamian cities. They brought wood from the Himalayas. And then I said, and, you know, I think I read somewhere that they found a chicken bone or two. And the editor said, great, that's it. Write about the chicken. And I said, excuse me? So that launched me on a very long and fascinating journey to many countries to try and find out, what is a chicken? Where does it come from? I really had very little idea. And I found out that there's a lot of exciting new research happening right now, looking into a problem that daunted Darwin. Even Darwin was very curious about this issue, and but didn't have the data that today's genetics and archaeology can provide.
Mm. Well, I want to dig into that. Let me ask you, though, did it change your perception of the chicken, knowing its history?
Absolutely. What I discovered, to my great surprise, was that there is no more important relationship on Earth than the relationship between humans and chickens. That's a big statement, and yeah. I don't make it lightly, but there is no other animal that is more important for humans today than the ordinary chicken. Without the chicken, the cities that we live in would not be possible.
Yeah.
It would not be possible to produce the kind of cheap protein that that both eggs and meat make available to people who live in cities far from any farm. And in fact, I discovered that it was the chicken was a very central played a very central role in the early industrialization, both of the United States and of Britain. Mm. And that, to my surprise, the chicken is really what has changed us as we have changed it.
Well, let's start with this legend that you write about. I really like this because it gives you – it's funny how our perceptions have changed or our sense of the chicken. For example, and you've written about this, you often hear today people talking about, you know, when someone's a coward, you call them a chicken, or when they're, you know, freaked out about something, they're running around like a chicken with their head cut off, or they're when they're, you know, paranoid or something, they see the like they're like Chicken Little, you know, they see the sky
right.
falling, those kinds of things. But it wasn't always this way. I mean, there's this legend, this Athenian general's on his way to this battle and he sees these two cocks fighting and he gets inspired by it. I mean, there was a different impression at the time. Talk about that story.
Well, we think of chickens as this very, very cheap food.
Yeah.
But back in the ancient world, it was a very different perception, and particularly among men, because it's very likely that the chicken was domesticated not for meat, not for eggs, but it was first domesticated, although we can't prove it, but the evidence points to cockfighting yeah. as the reason. And in a sense, the chicken provided us with really, really good entertainment in the days before television, internet, etc. So if you wanted to have a good time, you would buy yourself a fighting cock and you would go to the local market, and there on a given day there would be a big cockfight.
Yeah.
And you would gamble. And this was something done primarily among the men. And at that point, you know, chickens, we're talking about roosters, of course,
yeah.
they were seen as the epitome of boldness and of courage. I mean, here were animals that would fight to the death. They would really fight to the death. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they became symbols of being kind of a martial society. France, for example, still has the cock as its national symbol. So the idea of the chicken as this kind of scaredy cat kind of creature is actually a pretty new idea, that cockfighting was really important. And back in ancient Athens, of course, it was seen as an example. It's like you would want soldiers to participate in cockfights. Caesar was big on cockfights. Mm-hmm. He wanted Roman soldiers to be able to witness the bravery so that when soldiers went into battle, they could imitate the chicken.
You point out also that in some cultures, chickens seen as sacred symbols of fertility, symbols of maternal instinct, for example, the hen on you know the other gender there. What did the egg represent? Though I suppose I can guess that was about fertility.
Well, there's the old, I think it was Samuel Butler who said that a hen is only an egg's way of making another hen. It's so interesting because you have on the one hand cockfighting, so you have roosters associated with men and fighting and kind of this aggressive gambling game. And on the other hand, you have the female chickens, the hens that are associated with motherhood, and they're considered the epitome of good child rearing. You know, here were animals that would care very, very carefully for their chicks. And that was seen as a kind of a moral story, that a woman should look to the hens and see how they do it and learn from them. So in both genders were drawing these very, very different lessons from the same animal.
Mm. I wanted to ask about there's a kind of – you refer to it as this kind of psychological comfort, for example, of a chicken dinner. And in America, there's a kind of nostalgia, chicken soup. I mean, that's about as comforting as it gets for us.
Well, there's actually a much deeper background. When we talk about chicken soup, you know, my grandmother always said I should eat chicken soup. Mm. Well, of course, there has been scientific evidence that shows that what gets made in chicken soup actually is quite good for you, and it's actually just the thing you want to eat when you're ill, particularly with something like the flu. But to go beyond that, the chicken was not just used for fighting. It was not just used as an example for motherhood or to produce eggs. It was also a way to get well. The chicken was really key for so many ancient medicinal preparations. There's even what I think has to be the absolutely the grossest recipe I've ever heard for anything, and that is it begins first, squeeze a chicken. So chickens were used in innumerable ways for all kinds of potions, both to cure physical ails as well as emotional ails, as well as even today in places like Bali or in Indonesia or in places like the Caribbean, you have a lot of people who use the chicken for exorcism, for purposes that have to do with receiving the demons or receiving evil spirits. Chickens have long played that role. So both for health as well as for religious aspects, the chicken has been it's incredible how many roles this one little bird has played.
So you mentioned that it's complicated to sort of pinpoint the first chickens, but we do think one of the first versions of a chicken was a red jungle fowl, and this came from Southeast Asia, we think.
That's correct. The red jungle fowl is a very beautiful bird. Looks like a small chicken. It has this beautiful kind of black and red and blue, really bright blue feathers. It's a really striking animal, and it lives in a wide area across South Asia, all the way from India, from the foothills of the Himalayas in India, all the way to the island of Sumatra. Mm. That's its natural range. So that covers all of Southeast Asia and a good chunk of India as well. So it's really a vast area that this bird has thrived in for millions of years. Mm. And what's unusual about it, and the real puzzle is this. When I went to see a purebred red jungle fowl, or as pure as we know that exists, yeah, it practically flew against a cage to kill itself. It was so terrified. It is an incredibly shy bird that, kept in captivity, often will die of a heart attack if you approach it. So here's a bird that is one of the shyest of pheasants, because the chicken is actually a pheasant, and it, in its natural state, really doesn't want to be around people. It wants to hide deep, deep, deep in the forest. So one of the real mysteries has been, why this animal, of all the animals that people had to choose from, how did this bird that is so shy and kind of scrawny, it's not particularly large, how did it become central to our modern society?
Do we know?
Well, yes and no. We know a lot more than we did.
Yeah.
Darwin was able to, so this is maybe 150 years ago, Charles Darwin, the British naturalist, he actually used the chicken as an important part of developing his theory of evolution, because you could breed chickens quickly, so you could see how they change over time. So they were kind of living, he did quite a few experiments on chickens in order to see how they altered over generations. And he was interested in where the chicken came from and where it evolved from, because there were so many varieties, or hundreds and hundreds of varieties in the world today. But every single one of them goes back to the red jungle fowl. That wasn't known at the time. It was quite controversial. But he managed to collect chickens and red jungle fowl from all over the world, and he traced it back, and he came to the conclusion that, yes, indeed, every single breed of chicken, no matter if you're talking about the small little bantams that might weigh a pound or two, up to these enormous Rhode Island Reds that are quite hefty, they all come from this one chicken. So for him, it was a really important way of showing how evolution has how humans have altered chickens over time, taking this natural bird. So then the question was, where does it come from?
Right.
And he thought India, because, of course, the British controlled India then. Most of his birds that he saw came from India. But now the thinking is that probably Southeast Asia, probably around Vietnam, northern Vietnam, southern China, this is probably the heartland of the ancient chicken, where the chicken was first domesticated. Because when you go there, and I went there for this story, the interesting thing was you see lots and lots of different kinds of chickens, and there's incredible diversity in the villages, and that's probably a sign that that's where the chicken originally comes from.
And they taste different. You've talked about that too. The chicken and really
certainly
different.
Do.
Yeah.
Yes. Chicken is not chicken. Yeah. We talk about chicken, it tastes like chicken. Well, let me tell you, the chicken of Vietnam does not taste like chicken. And of course, I'm an American raised on white, dry chicken that was grown on factory farms. And I really thought that that was chicken. And that is one form of chicken. But in most of the world, even today, most people eat a very different kind of animal. The animal they're eating tends to be a little bit smaller, and they're specialized. So when I was in Vietnam, to my surprise, I was told, okay, so if you're feeling if you're feeling this way, you want to eat this kind of chicken, or if you're feeling that way, if you're cool, eat this chicken. If you feel warm, eat that chicken. That they have different chickens based on how you feel in the moment and what your body needs. So, for example, they bred a chicken that is black, and I don't mean black feathers.
Yeah.
I mean black feathers, black bones, black blood, black meat.
Wow.
Black organs. And this is a chicken that's considered very yin, very kind of feminine. So it's it can provide you with that little extra boost that you need if you feel you are depleted in your yin. So it's fascinating to see that that there in what may be the heartland of the ancient chicken, you actually have people using it both as food. They also use it for medicinal purposes. And, of course, they're doing a lot of cockfighting there.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you write about the relationship between the Romans and the chickens. The Romans, for example, considered the chicken a delicacy. But then there's this law that they created where you could only eat one chicken per meal. And they were, I guess they were concerned about the methods that were used to, you know, to fatten a chicken. I mean, the Romans were like the modern Americans, I guess. They really figured out how to make these birds big.
People love to eat chicken. I mean, that is a constant. And the Romans figured out if you feed enough grain to a chicken, then you get a nice fat chicken.
Yeah.
But at that time, this is maybe 2nd, 3rd century BC, so very early in the Roman Empire, they were having to import grain. And to import grain was dangerous because if you're importing grain, you're depending on your potential enemies. And if they decide, just like an oil embargo today, if they embargo the grain, you're in real trouble. So the problem was that Romans were going nuts for chickens and they were spending all of their money buying grain to feed to chickens, which is a very inefficient way of using your grain if you have limited quantity. So, of course, over and over again, the Roman Senate tried to pass these laws. And, of course, everyone pretty much ignored them, and I'm sure the senators would go off to their chicken dinner. The law actually was you could only have one chicken on your table per meal,
yeah.
And I have a feeling that that was a law that was broken more often than it was kept.
Well, it's the story of the Romans. I mean, this seems to be this seems to sort of indicate the cycle of these kinds of things, because you talk about the domestic chicken really falls with the Roman Empire, so chickens get small again. Ducks and geese become more popular. There's kind of a cycle there, at least for a time, it seemed.
Absolutely. And I write a lot about archaeology. And what I found to my surprise was that chickens actually can serve as an important marker for archaeologists who want to know kind of how orderly a society is. If your society is very disorderly, there's a lot of chaos, a lot of war, a lot of violence, you're not taking care of, say, the animals that might come around and want to eat your chickens. You know, if you live in that kind of society, you're not going to have many chickens. And so the Roman Empire was a golden age for chickens because the Pax Romana, it was a very stable time over a vast area for a long period. And so chickens could really blossom. They could become a key part of the food chain, whereas before they had not been. And afterwards, when the Roman Empire fell, well, you know, in the so-called Dark Ages, you had smaller farms, you had more predators, both humans as well as animals that could come and eat your chickens or even destroy you. So it was a more unsettled time, and the chicken doesn't fare well when things aren't settled. Mm. The chickens really like regularity. They like to have a place, a safe place to go at night, to roost at night. They like to be fed regularly. They like to be able to move around without being fearful of predators. So this requires a lot of organization. So when you have a chicken, you have civilization. If you don't have chickens, odds are it's something different.
How did they get here to the New World, this continent?
Now, that's a great question, because it is a hot topic right now,
yeah,
among archaeologists. The thinking has long been that Columbus brought them.
Right.
Actually, Columbus, on one of his voyages, I think his third voyage, he brought chickens along, and then other Spaniards brought their chickens. You know, you would take it along like you would take along your, you know, bag of Doritos, and you carried supplies with you. And the chicken was a really wonderful, portable, an easy animal because it would produce eggs. You didn't have to slaughter it for it to be productive.
Yeah.
So carrying them on ships was a natural. So that was the thinking. In the 1500s, a chicken then spread quickly throughout the Americas. But people began to notice that it's kind of odd because chickens did seem to appear really early, like within a generation. You had them in the far parts of South America in places that Europeans had never been. Well, okay, maybe the chicken just was adopted quickly and spread among Native Americans, both South and North Americans, but mainly we're talking South America. But then an archaeologist from New Zealand with her colleagues from Chile, they discovered what they believe are pre-Columbian chicken bones. Mm. Now, that's pretty exciting. It may not sound exciting, but those bones were dated, and the dates that came back were before 1492. That could mean only one thing. If the dates were correct, that could only mean that somebody else had brought chickens to the New World, because chickens are not native to the New World. There were no chickens native to North or South America. So then the question was, well, who could possibly have brought them? Well, they found these bones on the west coast of South America, on the Chilean coast, and it's clear that the Polynesians were moving in the other direction as the Europeans were moving through the Atlantic and then into the Indian Ocean. The Polynesians had already colonized large parts of the largest ocean of all, the Pacific, and they brought the chicken with them wherever they went. You go to Hawaii today, you'll see chickens, like on the island of Kauai, you'll see lots and lots of kind of feral chickens running around that are the result of the chickens brought by the original settlers in, say, 1000 or so AD. We know they got to Easter Island. We know there were chickens on Easter Island because there are actually stone coops on Easter Island. When they weren't building those giant heads,
right.
Those giant stone heads, they were building very big stone chicken coops.
Wow.
And, you know, it's clear that chickens are important. So the question is, did they make it to the coast of South America? And that's still a hotly debated topic because it's not clear if the dating is correct or not. And there's been a lot of back and forth in the scientific literature. And probably, I think, in the next couple of years, that will be resolved. But it certainly is an exciting question because as the chicken moves, so humans move. Because chickens can't move by themselves, obviously. They don't fly very far. Certainly don't fly over water. So when you find a chicken bone, it tells you something about the people that lived there previously.
Andrew Lawler is with us. He's a writer, a freelance journalist who's written about, among a lot of other things, the natural history of chickens. We have links to his articles on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Andrew Lawler, stay with us. More to talk about the natural history of the chicken. And we're hoping to hear from you, those who have relationships with chickens, who keep them in the city. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about chickens. More and more people in surprising places like urban settings are keeping these little flocks in their backyards. For some, it's about the eggs. Sometimes it's about the meat. Sometimes the birds become pets. Those who keep them say they're not so bright, but they're really charming creatures. And so we're talking about the experience, the joys and challenges of urban chickens today. Also, their natural history. Andrew Lawler is with us to talk about that. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Tom, who's in Heber, Utah. Tom, welcome.
Well, thank you, Doug.
Sure.
I don't mean to embarrass you, but I have such a crush on you. Sorry. Yeah, I had two chickens. I used to live in Midway, and Thelma and Louise,
right.
And they were just charming as hell. I had three cats and a dog, and they would sleep on top of the dog and snuggle up with the cats. They were just charming as hell.
Yeah.
I really miss them. I would love to have chickens again.
D- But did you start that way, though? I mean, did you start with them thinking, oh, these are going to be charming animals? Or did you think, no, I need some, meat and eggs?
No, I was just intrigued with them. Huh. And, I got an egg a day out of each of them. And so that was perfect. And that was, I really had no preconceived idea about chickens at all. But, oh, my God, they are just charming as hell.
Hmm.
Just go out gardening, and they'd be right behind you getting bugs and stuff. They were just delightful.
That's great. Tom, thanks. Glad you called.
Okay. Thank you, Doug.
All right. Cheers. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Joining us is Novella Carpenter, who is an urban farmer in Oakland, California, the author of a number of books, among them Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. She's joining us from the studios of Youth Radio in Oakland. And Novella Carpenter, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Doug. Great to be with you.
Well, let me start with your involvement with chickens, because this goes back a ways. This was like 1998, and I guess it was right on the edge when it was I guess this was before, actually, it caught on as a trend, though I guess it was becoming a thing. But this was a long time ago when you first thought about raising chickens.
Yeah, I was living in Seattle at the time, and it was just there's been waves of chicken love, as you probably imagine. so it was really popular to keep chickens, maybe not in urban areas so much, but yeah, so the late 90s, it was kind of starting to be a little bit of a trend.
Yeah.
Part of it was I kind of blame Martha Stewart because she was sort of like you'd see pictures of her on her farm and she'd be, snuggling a chicken and holding like beautiful Easter egg colored eggs. And you'd be like, wow, can I do that? And I lived in, pretty close to downtown Seattle. And I just thought, you know what? It's really not. That wouldn't be that far of a stretch to, build a chicken coop in my backyard.
Yeah.
So we did that. And, my construction skills are pretty limited. So it's kind of like Ozark type situation in the backyard. And the chickens are all running around and the neighbors are like, oh, God, what happened? But I loved them. I had Golden Lace Wyandottes and I had four of those and then one sort of beware when you buy chickens. I had I went to the country to buy my chickens and this guy, he knew, he was like, oh, we got a city slicker. And so he was like, here, you can have this one for free.
Right.
I was like, oh, thanks. And so like this little black banty,
yeah.
We named her Agnes. And she was, she became sort of the pseudo rooster, like she would do this weird, she was a chicken. She was a hen. She laid a small blue egg almost every day, but she would also try to crow. And she was very cute. So chickens. And then it became a thing. And now it's definitely a thing. You go to dinner parties and people are talking about their chickens and, there's chicken fanciers and there's a magazine called Hen House that's like chicken porn. It's crazy.
How do you describe your relationship with the chicken? So you've got six right now, if I get that right.
Yes, that's right.
So, but there's the practical part, right? Where the eggs and maybe meat. Mm-hmm, but then there's the other part too, right?
I know. Well, I'm so practical, though. You know, that's my thing. But I actually had some friends of mine raised chicks for me because I have a little baby, and I was like, oh, I can't deal with more poop. So she raised the chicks, And when she brought them over, and they were, full size chickens, she cradled each one of them and had named them and pet them and put them down into the, coop. And I'm just like, all right, you guys, here's your dinner. And I wasn't gonna hold the chickens, but this is something that some people do, and there's no judgment. I think that's great if you have the time to hold a chicken. So for a lot of people, they're very much like pets. For me, I'm more practical. I'm just like, if they're not laying eggs, then I probably won't keep them around. And so at a certain age, they'll stop laying eggs or they won't lay as many eggs. And that's when you start to see the difference between like a person who sees them as like a farmer would see them and a person that considers them pets.
Yeah. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Let's go back to the phones. Melanie with us in South Jordan. Melanie, hi.
Hi. We have chickens in our backyard. We have five. One died this summer, but I grew up on a dairy farm, and we had chickens and pigs, and I wanted my kids to have the same, kind of the same experience I did. And it's been great. They're our pets, and we, you know, we love the eggs, and it's so fun to see my kids with them. But there has been a downside. It attracts, their food attracts all kinds of other critters.
Yeah.
Last year, we had a family of rats living under our shed, and this year, it's been more of like the starlings and stuff that eat all their food. But it really, all in all, it's been a great experience. And it's so fun to see my kids. My one boy calls himself the chicken whisperer. He goes out and holds them and feeds them. And it's been a lot of fun for us.
Yeah. Well, Novella, you've talked about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kids love chickens in a way they wouldn't love a duck or certainly not a goose.
I know. It's incredible. You know, we had ducks when I first had my daughter, and she was terrified of them because, you know, they're not gentle. You know, they come running, they bum rush her, and as ducks will. And then they've got those beaks, and they're kind of like touching everything with their beaks, whereas chickens are more like the kind of thing where they're scratching with their feet and it's more gentle. Mm. So, oh my God, chickens and kids, they just go hand in hand. And there's nothing cuter than, you know, a little 2-year-old scooping up a chicken and just petting them. And they're so gentle. It's true. They're wonderful creatures.
Yeah.
So I think it's a huge thing. It's also a way for people to get in touch with their food. You know, in cities, a lot of times, you know, kids, they don't even, they're like, eggs come from the store. So people have backyard chickens and they know where eggs come from now. You know, they come from the chicken.
Yeah. Melanie, cheers. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
801-585-WEST. Again, the number 2. To join us. Let's see. Dusty is with us in Salt Lake. Dusty, welcome.
Hey, Doug.
Hey.
Nice to talk to you again.
You too.
Hey, I just wanted to chime in. I'm completing a treehouse right now for my chickens in my backyard and building a ramp to get them up to the upper world so they can partake with the rest of the birds of the treetops. And our chicken history goes back into my high school days. We bought some chickens and attempted to treat them like parrots to sit on our shoulders. Unfortunately, we selected a breed called Silkies that have 5 toes and are flat-footed and incapable of perching. So we're hoping this next go-around does a little better. We have an Americana and a Dominique as well as a Silky and a Frizzle to attempt that with.
Wow. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Does a chicken poop more than a parrot, Novella, do you think?
The poops are, how can you say, they're sometimes rather wet.
Yeah.
Not like a duck, but, you know, it's not. Yeah, it's definitely a larger poop than a parrot would do. And they're kind of, I think maybe parrots might do it while they're flying or something, where chickens are just, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how many times we've done like a photo shoot and they're like, can you hold a chicken? And then it's like, I've got poo on me.
Yeah. Here's an email from Carmen, who writes, my husband and I are currently building the Taj Mahal of a chicken coop in our backyard for our 2-month-old young chickens. Of all the projects we've launched, she writes, I'm not convinced this new structure is adding any value to our property. But we have thoroughly enjoyed the birds and can't wait for the eggs. Though this is probably not for everyone, which I guess is a good point, right, Novella? It's not for everyone?
Yeah. You know, I mean, the coop construction is a huge thing too. You know, for a lot of people, they get the chickens and they're raising them, they're getting chicks and then they raise them in the house and they're sort of this looming thing that we need to build a coop. And you have to build a coop that's predator-proof, you know, because like the woman was saying about the rats. I mean, there's also raccoons and opossums, even in the city. And if you live in the country, foxes and all kinds of, you know, things will come in and try to eat your babies. So that's a huge thing. So it's for people that want to build, either they have construction skills and they want to kind of perfect them or they have a friend that will do that for them. So just that alone is a big thing. I also can't tell you how many people I've met that are one member of the couple really wants chickens and the other one is like, no way, honey, no way.
Right.
You know, because there is still a little bit of a stigma about it. Like, are we hillbillies? You know what I mean? Like, if we have chickens in the backyard, are we hillbillies?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like it just keeps going on, even though, you know, you'll see these chicken mansions and, you know, so.
Yeah. Do we want to be those neighbors?
Exactly.
Those guys. Yeah. Yeah. More and more people are those guys, though, it seems. Right?
Oh, yeah. It's a huge trend. But she was saying, the woman said about the rats, that's another major problem in cities. And that's why a lot of times people are bummed when they have a chicken move in, a chicken house move in. And the other thing is the rooster crowing.
Yeah.
That can be – and you don't need a rooster. I just want to – a lot of people don't know that. I'm sure Andrew could talk about that. But, you know, they're just they'll lay eggs no matter what if there's a rooster around or not.
Yeah. 801-585-WEST. Let's go back to the phones. Jason in Delta. Hi, Jason.
Hey. How's it going?
Great.
I just had a comment about roosters. I'm here in Delta, which is farm country, and I personally don't have a whole lot of experience with chickens, but I do have a friend that raises chickens, and her rooster is the most terrifying animal I have ever beheld in my life. Those things are vicious. Or at least hers is. Her dogs are terrified of it. You know how they always say that if you're worried about your house being burgled, get a dog? I would recommend a rooster.
A rooster, right? But that's the hardest thing, though. I mean, you can't – I don't think you can – can you in most city environments even keep a rooster? I mean,
I have no idea.
Novella, do you know?
Yeah, well, most cities have, you know, so it's been this history of like there's been a ban on chickens in most cities, and then there's been this sort of resurgence of people wanting to have chickens, so they changed the laws. And usually within those laws, it says no roosters. But in neighboring Berkeley, where I live in Oakland, but next door in Berkeley, they actually made it legal to have roosters. And there, I can't tell you, you know, the city council meetings were crazy with rooster lovers. And it was sort of like, this is the most natural thing. And I was actually thinking about the Roman times. It's kind of like there were these people that were such hardcore rooster, you know, lovers that they changed it. So the law is you can't have roosters in Berkeley. But it's illegal in most cities, including Oakland. So if you have a rooster and your neighbors complain, the animal control will come and whisk him away.
Yeah. Jason, thanks. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Novella Carpenter is with us, an urban farmer in Oakland, California. She's author of the book Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, also the book The Essential Urban Farmer. She's with us from the studios of Youth Radio in Oakland. 801-585-WEST. Again, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in the moment. A moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about chickens, and we hope you'll join us. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Novella Carpenter is with us, an urban farmer in Oakland, California. Andrew Lawler is also with us, a freelance journalist who's been writing about the natural history of chickens. Here's an email from Carol who writes, "My husband first bought 3 chickens for my son's as pets. I had no clue what to do with them at all. 2 died. We were left with 1 rooster, Grandpa Chicken. He would terrorize the neighborhood, but would crow and crow at the front door until I would come outside. It was very endearing," she says. "We've had chickens on and off since then, and I've enjoyed them very much. I can't bring myself, though," she says, "to eat what I raise, so they've all been pets. I love to watch them. They're very entertaining." This is the problem, Novella. If you get to know your chicken, it's harder to eat it, right?
Yeah, I mean, for some people, I think it's a rooster for me when they start crowing at, you know, 2 a.m., 2:30 a.m., 3 a.m. You know, it's kind of like time for Mr. Grandpa to go away.
Right.
So I feel pretty motivated. But, you know, and also if it's a young rooster, it's actually going to be edible. So there's a time sort of, you know, constraint too that you need to kind of meet. But, you know, I think it's true that a lot of people will be not excited about culling a chicken. Yeah. You know, a lot of times you'll get an older chicken and, you know, it's been held in the arms of your children, and then kind of trying to picture it on the dinner table is pretty unappetizing.
Yeah.
But for me, you know, a lot of times if I raised a meat chicken, for instance, there's different breeds that are more suitable for the table, perhaps, then the plan would be, you know, from day one, from the day that that's a little chick, that this is going to be eaten. So I think it's more about intent for people. And then, you know, so it's not as hard if you're a farmer that you're like, okay, I'm raising these meat chickens and I'm going to serve them and they're going to be delicious. Whereas, you know, if you've named Penny, you know, having her on the table might not be appetizing. Yeah. So I can see that. I can see the problem. I mean, the thing is that old birds, this is just a little peasant secret, is that you're never going to – like if you have like a five-year-old chicken, you know, and she's sort of stopped laying, she's done her service for you, you're not going to eat her as a you know, like a roasted chicken. You're going to put her and make the best soup that you've ever made in your life because they have all this fat. So an old bird actually makes the best soup stock. So that's what I would do with my old chickens. Mm. I just couldn't afford to keep feeding them. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's like a cost problem.
Sure. 801-585-West. Again, the number to join the conversation. Back to the phones. Lindsay is with us in Salt Lake City. Lindsay, welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
Kind of my comment is that I think that, you know, backyard chickens allow people to get more in touch with their egg source, and that's great. But unfortunately, the gross majority of chicken and eggs in our country come from large-scale industrial factory farms where, you know, the chicks live in dark, cramped battery cages and male chicks are ground up and tossed out alive. And so, and I consider this very unnatural and, you know, inhumane farming. So I'm just wondering, can your guests speak to this change in unnatural farming?
Yeah. Well, this brings us back to Andrew Lawler, by the way. Andrew Lawler, you say it wasn't really until the 20th century that the chicken took off as an industrial kind of product.
Yes. In fact, in the 19th century, there was a big debate that went on in Britain and America about whether or not chickens could be raised on a mass scale. There was one group that argued that no, chickens can only be raised if they're raised so that the mother is close and they have a kind of family bond, and otherwise they get sick and die. Mm. Because people who attempted to bring chickens together in large numbers, they tended to get disease, and the disease spread, and they died off. So there was really a question of whether the chicken could ever be something that was mass-produced. But with the advent of new medicines and the diagnosis of various diseases, they were able to find ways to keep them alive. And by World War I, really the mass production of the chicken first began and it picked up its pace after World War II, at which point it became really a very large-scale industry that drove out a lot of the smaller chicken farmers who had lived in places like Petaluma in California and some places scattered around the East Coast. And it became a very consolidated, concentrated corporate endeavor, much like happened in other parts of the food industry.
Well, going back to what Lindsay was talking about, then so we end up then with this, you know, as many as 30,000 birds crowded together in these windowless buildings. Talk about the life of an industrial chicken. It just seems really depressing and incredibly sad.
Well, there's been some really interesting behavioral research that's been going on in the past decade or two to understand what do chickens feel? How do they feel? How do they perceive the world? And this is really an important part of this debate of whether chickens actually feel pain, how they feel pain, how they're similar to humans, how they're different from humans. And a lot of the research is showing, and this is independent research, it's done by people who aren't paid by anybody who's an advocate of one way of raising chickens or the other. They've shown that chickens have really a surprising amount of ability to feel and to react to unfavorable circumstances and to remember and to learn. There's some fascinating research going on in Italy. I was just at a lab not long ago where they were doing behavioral research where the professor actually set up a series of logical questions for chickens to answer by ways of you get grain if you get it right. And he said to his amazement, two-day-old chicks have an incredible capacity for logic that even superseded some of his graduate students. And he was only being joking so far. He really was astonished that the chicken actually turns out has a very well-developed brain at an extremely early age. That's the big surprise.
Well, Novelle, I mean, this brings us back to this idea, like, what is a chicken, like, what's the natural behavior of a chicken? And have we stripped out so much of their natural instinct or who they really are? I mean, surely you think about this from time to time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of even the domesticated breeds that we have today, you know, like the Rhode Island Reds and the Barred Rocks, the full-size chicken, they don't have that – a lot of them don't have the instinct to sit on eggs. So that sort of wanting to raise up, you know, chicks is not – is sort of – has been bred out of them.
Yeah.
But if you get a little banty, they're like the smaller size chicken, they still have that ability. And so they'll want to go – and you can see why people don't want your chicken to sit on eggs and hatch them out, because you are going to eat the eggs.
Yeah.
you want her to lay more eggs, not hatch out chicks.
Right.
But you know, like the caller said, you know, that's one huge thing is like a lot of people order chicks through the mail, through hatcheries, and they'll actually send these little tiny peeping chicks to your house. It can be a really grim industry because, you know, they'll take out the males, like she was saying, and just put them in a dumpster or whatever. So you want to make sure when you order your chicks that you ask them, what do you do with the males, and really support businesses and hatcheries that are a smaller scale and are doing it in a humane way. Mm. Just to touch on that. But yeah, so, I mean, their natural instinct for chickens is they want space outside. They want to take a sun bath. They want to take a dust bath. And they want to be around others. You know, the woman was talking about her one rooster. That is a sad place for a chicken to be. They want to have other chickens around or roosters, you know, because they're flock animals. And
yeah.
So they need partners in crime and they want dirt to scratch in. And that's why it's so sad when you see these factory farms that are making eggs or meat, is it's just completely erasing any sort of what the chicken would normally want to have in its life.
Well, Andrew Lawler, you write about the fact that the selective breeding has made the chickens that we, you know, eat at the supermarket so docile that they're really not interested in going outside when they do give them the opportunity.
Yeah, this is one of the kind of sad stories that this idea of having chickens that are free range. Well, often that can mean just a flapping door on the one end of a coop that chickens, if they choose, could go outside to scratch around, and most choose not to. So there's a lot of, I think, kind of false advertising that goes on around how chickens are raised and the labels that are given to them. Because we are breeding chickens now, like it or not. Most of the chickens, as we're saying, are bred to stay indoors and to produce. They've often even lost the ability to go out in the yard and scratch up worms. That's a really fundamental trait that we have on purpose bred out of chickens.
Yeah, it's true. I accidentally ordered some meat chickens that were not like a cross of anything. They were the standard white ones, you know?
Yeah.
And they were the laziest chickens I've ever seen. Like they would literally they would sit on the ground and eat. You know what I'm saying? They wouldn't even stand and eat. It was incredible.
Wow.
Yeah. Ugh, Franken chickens.
Okay, back to the phones. Janice is with us in Murray. Janice, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to get Andrew's take on the idea that small-scale chicken farming as a bellwether of economic success or lack thereof. My grandparents urban chicken farmed during World War II because meat was scarce, and then my parents did the same thing in the 70s because of rising costs as well. Do we see from the Roman Empire on forward where chicken farming would get smaller and smaller and more specialized as economic conditions changed?
Yeah, I want to hear you on that too, Novello. But Andrew, start with that question.
Well, I think the movement towards small chicken farming is certainly a positive one because it's bringing attention to how we get our food. And as Michael Pollan and others have written about, you know, this is really essential in our relationship to nature and to the wider world. At the same time, we have to be realistic. China is going to be creating 250 million urban dwellers in the next few years. And it is simply impossible at this moment to imagine a China where you have small-scale farming, who are, you know, people who are feeding those people. I was talking to a Chinese geneticist recently, and he said he went back to his home village not long ago. He's a chicken specialist. And he said to his horror, he couldn't find any chickens at all.
Mm.
Even this remote part of China, already, he said, people were going to the supermarket. They'd already lost the ability to know how to house chickens and to raise them and to butcher them. So this is, while in the United States this movement is happening, and to a certain extent in Europe, I think we should keep in mind that the vast majority of the world is moving in exactly the opposite direction, and that is toward more intensification of chicken farming. So I think that this movement could really help as a bellwether. It could certainly spread. But we should keep in mind that the chicken is right now kind of locked into this role of feeding the urban masses who are growing, you know, by the millions every day.
Novelle, what do you think about that question?
Well, I know it's hard because, you know, if you're building the Taj Mahal for chicken and then you do a cost analysis, you're feeding them organic feed and, you know, all the stuff, then you're keeping them as pets, then you kind of do a cost analysis and it's like, you know, each egg would cost $2, you know. I mean, it doesn't – and so it's kind of nice because, like, America, you know, we have this whole explosion of people having pets, and so chickens are just kind of, you know, I call them more like – edible pets or pets with benefits, you know.
Yeah.
But it's kind of that's our model here because we have extra money. But, you know, so that's my only concern, is that I worry that it's just kind of a fun thing that people like to do as a hobby. And then – but ultimately, can everyone afford to have their own coop in their backyard? Yeah. So then you start wanting to think of other models. And I knew people in Portland – I'm not sure if this is an episode of Portlandia or not, but they collectively owned chickens. And it was like, you know, families shared the coop and the chickens, and that kind of made more sense. You know, because then everyone would get eggs and they would be shared, and it was sort of like a commune type situation. But so that kind of made more sense, maybe, because does everyone need a coop in their backyard? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Novelle Carpenter, urban farmer, author of two books, Farm City and The Essential Urban Farmer, joined us from the studios of Youth Radio in Oakland, California. Novelle, thanks again for being with us. It was great.
Thank you. It was a blast.
And Andrew Lawler, freelance journalist. He's been writing about the natural history of chickens, and we'll put a link to the articles that he's been writing on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Andrew Lawler, thanks to you.
Thank you, Doug. I enjoyed talking all things chicken.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Michael Havey today. Our theme music was composed by The Moth and the Flame. Walker Adams is our intern. Our thanks also to Susan Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. Go to our website and you can continue the conversation. Tell more chicken stories. I'm Doug Fabrizio.